I don't know why, it never bothered me. But all of a sudden, this week, it started bothering me. After all these years, we've learned the beginning of Vayera, we know it all from childhood. 60 years, 70 years. And all of a sudden, I look at it in a completely different light. Let's read a few psukim. Vayera, Edo Hashem, Ve'elonen Mamrei, Vuhu Yoshei, Petach Ha'oel, Petol Magon. And God appears to him. Obviously, the Torah assumes that we remember what it said at the end of Parashat Lech Lecha. At the end of Parashat Lech Lecha, it was talking about Avraham Avinu, who had undergone circumcision. So, Vayera El Hashem, God appears to him in a loving and ready sitting at the opening of his tent at the heat of the day. Rashi points out, Kechom Hayom. Rashi points out, Hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chama Min Artiko. God took the sun out of its orbit and brought it closer to Earth so that it should be a very, very hot day. So that nobody would be out there in the streets. So that Avraham should not be troubled by guests. Why does God appear to him? So Rashi says, Levaker et hachola, to visit the sick. It was the third day after his circumcision. Rashi says, he is 99 years old. He's not well. So God comes to visit him. Why is Avraham sitting at the opening of his tent? So Rashi says, lit up. In Yesh Over Vashav, he's looking out there to see if there's anybody. Over Vashav, those probably already have gotten used to it. We think it's a bank. You check your Over Vashav. Over Vashav, what's coming and what's going? There are people who want to see who's coming and who's going out in the streets, but it's an extremely, extremely hot day. Why is he looking to see if there's anybody in the street? He's saying that they know, so he should bring them into the house. And then, as we said, Rashi says, "Hotzi Hakadosh Baruch Hu Chama Min Artikar Shalom Hatricho Baruch Hu." He shouldn't be troubled with guests. Ulefi Sheraahu Mitzta'er Shalom Hayuarchim Bayim. God sees that he is in pain because there's nobody in the streets. There are no guests. Heidi Malachim Alav Bidmut Hashem. So he brought angels who looked like men. Most probably because human beings wouldn't walk out into the street. So you have to bring angels. I don't have an answer to another question. Why didn't he just cool the weather down?
Yeah.
Obviously, there must have been another reason why he felt he had to bring Malachim. I mean, we know what it's like out there. You remember? And by now you forgot already. A week ago, Shabbos.
Very hot, right.
It was very hot. I was away in a hotel for Shabbos. I stuck my head out onto the porch twice and went running back in. It was terribly hot. Nobody's around. Everybody's indoors. We know what a hot day is like. So here it is. Our phone's looking out to see if there's anybody who's coming. And God sees that he's very upset, so he brings him Malachim. And he lifted his eyes, Vayara, he saw him, three people, he saw him, Malachim, standing there. Vayara, he saw them. He saw, and then he understood that they need a place where to go. The word Vayara doesn't always mean just visually seeing, it also means intellectually. It registers. Vayoratz of Rabbi, we ran toward them. Remember, hot, 99 years old, third day of his bris milah, and he runs for them from the opening of the tent by Yishtachu Arza, he bows down to the ground. Meanwhile, he has a problem. The problem is, here, God has come to visit him. He has a guest in his house. God has come, Levaker Tachola, to visit the sick. How do you just drop God and go running out after those people? The dilemma that we would face if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with us and our cell phone goes off. So what do you do? I would imagine that you would have to ask for the rightful person, please, and I'd like to answer the phone. You know, people have lost that sensitivity already. A cell phone can break into the most serious conversation of all. It shouldn't be that way. All right. So the next passage says, Vayomer, he said, Hashem, in no matzah, ichem ve'necho, alma tavon yav. Therefore, there are two ways to read this passage, as you said. One way to read this passage is that he's speaking to God. The Aleph Dalet Nun Yud is talking about God, the creator of heaven and earth, who is here visiting him now. And he asks him, please, I'd like to bring in these guests, stay a while, don't leave. The other passage is that the Aleph Dalet Nun Yud really means my masters, and he is referring to these three unknown, anonymous people who are walking out there, asking them, please come in, don't go away. Yukach Nama'at Mayim, let some water be taken, Verachatzurak Lechem, and wash your feet. Why does he want them to wash their feet? Because there were those who worshipped the dust of their feet, and he was concerned that they may be idolaters. He doesn't want in his house. He'll take anybody into his house, but he doesn't need to take something that smacks of idolatry into his house. V'yisharnu tachat ha'eitz. You can lie down and lean under the tree. You know, I'm going to read another few psukim, but I'm going to ask a question I never asked before. In Hebrew, modern Hebrew, the question would be simply, this isn't mugzam. This isn't exaggerated conduct on his part. Do yourself a favor, it's the third day. The Rebbeim's come to be Marka Chala. What are you sitting by the door of the tent, 99 years old, after a bris milah? Third day, you have a right to rest for a day. Phil Oyster, where are you running? For who? For what? I mean, we read this story as children, and we're overwhelmed by Avraham Avinu's goodness. I'll call a spade a spade. It's illogical. It's irrational. And who are these people? He suspects them that they may very well be idolaters. What would happen if he'd ask his doctor? Or his love? The doctor would say, stay in bed. Drink loads of fluids. It's very hot. His love would tell him, you have to take care of your health. There's still a lot you can do after your 99 years. What's he doing? Is this supposed to be something that we emulate? I don't believe that this is something we have to emulate. You sit. Father God, I sit. You don't have to fill your house up with guests when you're not well. Take care of yourself. And we read this like mine. What a beautiful story. We're talking about somebody we described last week as one of the most brilliant men who ever lived. And look how he's acting. But we're not finished yet. I'm going to take some bread to satisfy your hearts. Then you can leave. He's now a servant. You know, you've come to your servant. And they said, we will do what you said. The adrenaline starts moving in this old Avraham. The way he moves, just to read the psukim, it's enough to get yourself all worked up into a sweat. Vayemar Avraham Ho'ele, he runs to the tent, to Sora, and he says, Bahari, quickly make Shlosi in Kamasalas. Believe me, just trust me, Shlosi in three soin of flour is a very, very large amount. Lushi needed Basi Ugo to make cakes or breads. Velhabokar Razav Avraham runs now to the Bokar. Now, I'm sure that the Bokar are not in the house. He's going to have to go out into that terrible, terrible heat. Who goes out into the middle of the day in a terrible heat? Madmen and tourists. So here it is. He runs to the Elabokar Razav Avraham. And he took, Rashi explains, he brought three animals, so that each one of these dusty, dirty idolaters should have a tongue with mustard.
Oh.
On a hot day, a tongue with mustard. Give me ice coffee. Ice coffee is enough. Ice tea. What's he doing? And we read the story, and we read it year after year, and we don't have the nerve to ask the question that has to be asked. It's irrational. It's illogical. It makes no sense. How many times? It says already three times, and he hurried. He hurried and told her to hurry. And then he gives the boy, Yishmael, also has to hurry. And he took butter and challah and he places it and he gives it to them. All right. You got a question. It doesn't make any sense. In another little while, he's going to stand before God and he's going to pray for Sodom and Amorah. And not merely pray. He really confronts God. Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. The judge of the whole world is not going to do justice. Maybe there are 50, maybe there are 45, there are 40, there are 30, there are 20. We're talking about a major confrontation that's taking place. For who? For Sodom and Amorah. Sodom and Amorah represents the absolute antithesis of Avram. Take a look at these two pictures. Avram is the mad man of goodness. A guest comes to Sodom, puts his life in grave danger. They were the absolute opposite of him. They wanted nobody. They would take care of nobody. The Malachim are going to come to Sodom, and the people of Sodom want to kill them. We're talking about two unbelievable pictures. And these people who represent the complete opposite, everything that Avraham Avinu rejects, he's standing up and he's praying for them. It's not simply that he says, okay, we're going to say, put the tongue to Sodom. You know, he says, yeah, I'm alive. Please love it, please help Sodom. No, that's not what it is. He means it. He's very serious about it. This is real prayer. How often do we achieve real prayer during the course of a year? Now that somebody's sick in the family, it's already Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur. And this is our form of healing, most probably. He's crying. Tears are coming down the baby's line. Same stone. I'm going to ask the same question. It's illogical. It's irrational. Makes no sense. I'm talking about Avram's conduct. Four mighty powers. What are they called now? There are the four now? The quartet. I mean, I'm not making comparisons, but here are four mighty kings who conquered the whole world, and they've taken Lot captive. The moment he hears about it, he takes 318 men, and he goes riding off to war. If he would have stopped to ask a shayla, any self-respecting love would have told him, Avram, stay home. You're not going to endanger yourself. You don't stand a chance. He's riding out that night against four superpowers in order to save Lot. Noble to save Lot, but it's mad. Absolutely mad. Well, I better have a pretty good answer for our problem. I'm getting myself all worked up. In next week's Sedra, Eliezer is going to be sent to find a wife for Yitzchak. So at least one thing he has no instructions to find out if they're ready to pay for flops.
Flowers,
orchestra, photographer, liquor, and no question about it. Diva, I'll tell you, most probably they could afford a half a tent. A half a tent again. Okay. So here comes Eliezer. He comes to Paranaram, and there's a little Maidala. She's 3 years old. Let's say she's 13. That's okay. She's 13. He comes with his 10 camels. And the whole strange thing was, he starts to ask her for water because he sees the water coming up toward her. He already has an indication that this is an exceptional young lady. Despite that, he asks that she give him some water. And he's hoping, and that's exactly what she does. She says, "No, I'll give you water. I'll give you all of your camels. You understand? We have 10 camels. 10 camels have 10 big, husky, strong camel drivers. And they're most probably standing over there. Quite the plan. Cars, I don't know what they're doing. Maybe they're learning Torah. I'm sorry. It's a house of our own. 10 strong fellows. Gesindheffer. They're standing there, and this little 13-year-old, she is providing all the water. I'm going to ask about Rivka the same question that I asked about Avraham. Why can't she turn to them and say, listen, count Bista to go ahead and fetch her own water? What do you think I am? I'm your slave. What do you go, here's the water. Anybody who wants can have the water. You know the little Rifkala's conduct is irrational. Mad.
All right. I think what we have to do is we have to begin the questions are very clear. So now we have to begin the process of finding some way to understand what in fact Torah is telling us here. I said in one sentence last week that which I really want to elaborate on today. There's a dark side to genius. Avraham Avinu, as the Rambam described it, and we learned it last week, that magnificent first chapter in Hilchot Avodah Zarah, the Rambam, he describes Avraham Avinu as an awesome genius. Ad shenigmal ad shenolad amudo shel olam, Avraham Avinu is the pillar of the world. A whole world knows of the existence of God today because of a man of such awesome intellectual capacity and brilliance there most probably wasn't another like him from Avraham until today. Avraham Avinu is the genius par excellence. That's how the Rambam describes it. That's how he's described. But there's a dark side to genius. The dark side to genius is that the person who is a genius may very well also become one who is completely self-centered, conceited. He may become one who is a terror to all who surround him. He may become a destructive force, a vile individual. Chances for him to become the incarnation of evil far greater than for common man. That's the general rule. What I have to do now is I have to prove it. So we'll take a few minutes soon to prove it. And I'm going to make reference to a book called The Intellectuals by Paul Johnson.
B'kitzer, the book is fascinating. I've gone through it now for the 10th time because of this set. In this book, Paul Johnson takes some of the greatest geniuses of the last 150 years. If it took 100 years, he begins with Rousseau. Rousseau, Shelley, Byron, Tolstoy, Marx, Ernest Hemingway, Bertrand Russell, Gedalia. And he gives us a biographical insight into these people. They were the filth of the earth. And we will read some classic quotes from this book. Here were people who wrote about the importance of morality and ethics. Rousseau was the father of modern education. He had five children that he never brought home from the hospital. He sent them off into orphanages. Never wanted to know about it. Can you imagine such cruelty? Rousseau is the one who said, "There's never been born a person who loves as much as I love." I can admit quotes that either you're going to shrink in terror, or you're just going to laugh. You're going to laugh. But it's nothing to laugh at. Because their major parts of humanity have suffered at the hands of people who are absolutely evil, though brilliant. Brilliance is no guarantee of morality and goodness. Do you know what Avraham Avinu's greatest genius is? Not that he discovers God. And by the way, I'm going to give another answer to the question that we gave five answers to last week. We asked last week, there's a whole story of 70 to 75 years of Avraham Avinu's life, the great search for truth, until finally, by dint of his great genius, he discovers God and stands up to a whole world and begins to tell the world that there's one God. That story does not appear in Torah. Why doesn't it appear in Torah? I'm going to give another answer now. The reason why it doesn't appear in Torah is because to laud Avraham Avinu's genius can be a terrible mistake. If he doesn't take the next crucial step, his genius can turn out to be something so destructive, so evil, so vile, so cruel, so brutal. Avraham Avinu's genius was not that he discovered God. His genius was that he discovered the next step. Why God created man. What God wants of man. He learned something that is at the very heart of all of Torah, and he achieved it by his own genius. And he was ready to surrender everything to that next great step. The great step, I would call it, I use the term that Rav Soloveitchik uses in a different context, where he says the great contribution of Yahadut to the world was Kavod HaAdam, the dignity of man. The dignity and the infinite value of man, regardless of who he is. Because man is created in the image of God, he therefore has infinite value. The Halacha has said it in many fascinating ways. The Halacha and the Rambam. Goyim surround a city, and they say, "Give us one of your women so we shall defile her, and if not, we defile all of the women in the city." Can't give over a woman, even if it's going to mean that everybody in the city is going to be defiled. You know, logically, you can start making an argument. A million women should be defiled. Give one over, a sacrifice in Akedah. No. Or, if Goyim surround the city and they help, give us one person and we will kill him. And if not, we kill you all. We kill you all. The halacha is, in no circumstances can you give a Jew into the hands of Goyim to be killed. Not a chance in the world. If you want to take it to its theoretical ultimate conclusion, you know what it means?
What happens if all of Klal Yisrael are concentrated in one city? And the Goyim say, give us one. If not, we will destroy you all. The Halacha says, no, you can't give over anybody. Why can't you give over anybody? One of the reasons is, my chos is the dom of the dog, still of tvei. Why is your blood redder than anybody else's? Do you know what that theoretically means? That the Halacha may have sounded the death knell for the entire Jewish people. All Jews are in the city. They're all in one city. The Halacha says, no, we'll all be killed. What's going to be the Jewish survival? By the way, there's another similar instance when God at the end of the Seder tells Avraham Avinu to bring his one and only son, Yitzchak, onto the Akedah. You know what he's talking about? Destroying all Jewish history. It's all over. Yitzchak is gone, it's all over. So what's the halacha? The halacha is you can't give anybody over. Just as the halacha for Avraham Avinu is that he must put Yitzchak to death. So you're going to ask, but the survival of the Jewish people, isn't that the greatest good of all? The survival of the Jewish people, that's God's business. That's his promise. Let him worry about that. I don't have the right to become the one who is the guarantor of the survival of the Jewish people if it means breaking the halacha. Let the Levation worry about that. We don't have to be God's Fazargas. We don't have to take care of his business. Just take care of our own business. And our own business is listening to the halacha. The Chof says, take a look. There is most probably no other system of law whatsoever that says that North Lola Odom is better for a man she apilats lola toki shon ha'esh, that he should cast himself into a furnace rather than to embarrass somebody publicly. The Gemara equates embarrassing somebody publicly with murder. Wait, can you imagine? There is no other system of law that exists upon the face of this earth that would ever have formulated anything of the sort. Anybody who embarrasses somebody publicly, says, no, he's still blood. The Gemara says, does not have a share in the world to come. By the way, the Lord makes a fascinating comment. Doesn't say that about somebody who kills. Somebody who embarrasses somebody publicly. Because Torah is positing that every human being has dignity. And just like he has a right to all his possessions, he also has a right to his dignity as a human being, that you dare not inflict any kind of harm on that dignity. Here the Lord makes a very fascinating parenthetic remark where he talks about the language of political debate in the United States. And he says, even in the state of Israel, you can disagree, but you always have to disagree with dignity. What a week to have said that. I mean, it's been an undignified week from the beginning of the week. And, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult thing. I mean, it's not. It's a schwerze Sache.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people about whom we want to say certain things, and some people express those feelings about those people, but not. Shulchan Aruch doesn't permit it. The fact is, it's not permitted. What was said, calling a minister of defense a shakran and all of the rest, can't do that. You can disagree with the ideas of the principle, but you can't attack the man.
How about our Foreign
minister. The Deshi foreign minister?
Huh?
The Deshi foreign minister. Well, listen, he learned it from the French ambassador to England. About that dashing little country that's causing all of the trouble.
That's right.
But Kvod Ha'adam is a basic and fundamental principle upon which all of God is set. Avraham Avinu's genius is not only has he achieved an intellectual knowledge of the Rebbe Shalom, he's going one step further. He knows why God has created man, and by virtue of the fact that man is his handiwork, that man is infused, whoever he is. He is infused with a sanctity and a dignity that is his and dare not be violated. And you know what Avraham Avinu becomes? Because Avraham Avinu knows that the dark side of genius is that which can justify the worst crimes in all of history. He knows that he must go to the complete opposite side of the spectrum. A hot day, boiling hot day, a divinely hot day, 99 years old, third day bris milah, idolaters walking out of there, and he's going to run toward them. Because he says the creation ultimately of a greater and a better world is only going to be built on the foundation of a Rebbeinu Shalom and Kvod Ha'adam, the dignity of man. The Rav once formulated an amazing, very powerful example. He used it on a number of occasions. It's Erev Yom Kippur, the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Everything depends on the Kohen Gadol. All of the service in the Beit HaMikdash, the forgiveness, the atonement for all the Jewish people, all depend on that one man, the high priest. The halacha, of course, is that a high priest is not permitted to defile himself by contact with a dead body. And of all the strange things that happens, the Kohen Gadol is on the way to the Beit HaMikdash for the greatest of all days. And everybody's waiting. And he comes upon an unknown Jew dead in the street. What does he do? The halacha is Mes Mitzvah. The first person that comes has to, you know what he has to do? Forget Klal Yisrael, forget Yom Kippur, forget all the atonement. Who is this fellow? He may be a gunner, he may be a chotzeach, but there's a human body lying there dead. He simply has to drop everything. Forget everything he was trained for a whole lifetime. I could call a minute and Zaka will be there. One call and they'll all be there. No, the halacha makes it clear. He's the one who has to take that body and bury it. What's the underpinning of this halacha? What makes sense about this halacha? Only because Torah has seen the dignity of man above everything. Not only is there a dignity of man, there is also a sanctity to man. I was wondering also, isn't it amazing? Famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Am Shlosha Dvarim Ha'olam made the world stands on three pillars: Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim. Torah and the worship of God and Gemilut Chasadim." So Chazal tells us in a number of places that it all. They correspond, the three pillars correspond to the Shloshes Avos, the three fathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. One would have thought that the pillar of Torah, intellectual genius, is Avraham Avinu. The one about whom it says that Avraham Avinu fulfilled the whole Torah, even before it was given, because he arrived at an understanding and a knowledge of Torah from his own genius. No, that's not what it is. Torah is Yaakov Avinu. Avodah, service, worship, that's of course Yitzchak. He was the greatest act of service. גמילוס חסדו ומזעבלון. טיפין אמת ליעקב וחסד לאברהם, פסק סז. יעקב is אמת, what's אמת? אמת is Torah. אברהם אבינו is חסד. The great genius is the pillar of חסד. Because the great genius has made the even greater discovery than the discovery of God. The discovery of what God wants from man. I'm thinking, you know what started me on this? I'll tell you what started me on this. And what brought me back to rereading The Intellectual by Paul Johnson? I read an article, article in the newspaper, and I was either horrified or I wanted to tell. The great guru of the left in this country is Uri Avnery. Let me say what I have to say. We're talking Torah over here, and it's very important that you listen to what I have to say. Uri Avnery has been the head of, up until today, Gush Shalom. He advertises all over the world not to buy products from the Yudah Shamron, to take down all of the settlements, give back. He is the giant of the, I don't even want to call them the peace movement. He is a friend, there are so many pictures of him with Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is one of his great friends. He's a lover of all of mankind. So what's this article? It seems that two or three weeks ago there was a television program dedicated to his life and work. It seems that they studied all of the articles, thousands of articles that he wrote. They went through all of his writings and they put together this film, which I didn't see. I don't plan on seeing. And the fellow who's writing the article in the Corey Show says that there's one thing that they left out in the whole story of Uri Avnery, and you should know it's going to be so typical, unbelievably typical. And that is that when his mother died in 1989, in her will, she wrote that she has decided that her son Uri should not have one single lira of her money, and she explained in her will, first of all, because he simply abandoned her completely. And number two, because of his meetings with Sonny Gusto. The fellow who writes the article says, wait a minute. The fellow who writes the article says that this is the first time that this is being made public, though the will is a matter of the of public record. And then he went ahead and he interviewed members of the Uri Avnery's family. And he says the following. One of the members of the family said the following. The man is a man chasar leiv, no heart at all, the chasar yigashot. He has no feelings for anybody. All of his years, he never responded to an invitation from a chasana, a bar mitzvah, a bris, any event in the family. Never responded, never came, never participated. Once or twice during all the years, without even telling anybody in advance, he'd just come into the house and then disappear again. One night, he came on the Seder night. And it says we're not a religious family, but of course even a non-religious family in Israel has a Seder. He came. He made fun of the whole Seder and Yiddishkeit, and he disappeared. It's worse, and I tell you, I'll prove to you that it's absolutely typical. It's unbelievably typical. Sometimes he would come with his wife, Rachel. She worships him, and everything that she doesn't like is simply to serve him. By the way, that's precisely the description of Sonia, who was Tolstoy's wife, Helena, who was Ibsen's wife, all of them. They worship these people. they worship these people. But you know what kind of sacrifice? When she would come to meet the family, she played with the babies. But she never had a child of her own because he didn't want children. He likes cats. He likes cats. I think it was Tolstoy who loved dogs. Didn't like, Ibsen didn't like dogs. He hated dogs. They never had children. That was the great sacrifice that she made for him. He never wanted anybody in her family to come. The last few years of his mother's life, she was institutionalized. He came to visit her once, and that was all. He was asked to help the family put her someplace that was better because she was in a very decrepit old place, and he refused. And this man presents himself to the world as the one who loves everybody, loves the whole world, loves the Palestinian people, love, love, love. Just as Rousseau, who wouldn't take his 5 children home, but he said there is nobody in the world who has a capacity to love as I do. They were bad. We're talking about such vile evil. They go on to interview people who worked for him. There isn't a single one who has a relationship with him. He fought with everybody and got rid of them all after 20 or 30 years of serving him well. The same thing is true of every one of the intellectuals that he speaks of in this book. They fought with everybody. They were brutal, cruel, evil people, but geniuses who set the foundations for education, for government, for social welfare. Tolstoy wrote about the freedom of the peasants, the great peasants. He loved all the peasants. And his writings brought on the Bolshevik Revolution, which ended up with 20 million peasants being slaughtered by Stalin. It's a frightening story. There's a very dark side to genius. The brilliance of Abramov, you know, is one of the greatest geniuses of all time, that was able to make a tremendous step forward. And what he understands is that in order to make certain that the message he's going to send to the world for all time is going to be a message of truth, then he must become the Ish HaChesed. And nothing will stand in his way, because only if he takes that giant step of recognizing that God created man, and by virtue of the fact that God created man, man has dignity and man is holy. Chana. The Gemara says about Chana. You have it number one on the other side. In the first chapter of Shmuel. By the way, interesting. I don't know if any of you follow the Tanakh Yomi. If you learn 2 Prakim or read 2 Prakim of Tanakh a day, of the Vim Ketuvim, you finish all of Tanakh in 1 year. It may be formidable. Today they start the Shmuel Aleph, right? Chapters 1 and 2. Or just drop that, you know, little thought. The Gemara says, the rabbi said that she prayed for Zera Anashim, seed of man. What is seed of man? The Gemara gave a few answers. Then the Gemara says, Zera Shemuvlov Ben Anashim, one who is sort of, not really swallowed up, but not somebody who stands out. And the Gemara goes on to explain, Ki also Rabdini, when Rabdini came to Eretz Yisrael, he said, you know what she was praying for? She wanted a son, lo oruk, velo gutz. Not tall, not short. Not small, slightly built. Not stocky. Not too white, not too red. Velo chacham, ולא טיפש. ולא חכם, ולא טיפש. He doesn't have to be a genius. He shouldn't be a fool. She wanted an average, normal, intelligent child. That's what she wanted. Chana, I'm afraid to use it, she did not like the word. Chana was brilliant. I sometimes, you know, when I hear the people who take pride or bore you about their children or grandchildren who are so brilliant, such geniuses, so I listen, and I have a little promise. Good, healthy mind, a healthy mind, and a mensch. Chana. We learn from Chana how to pray. So not only should we learn from Chana how to pray with Kavana, what to pray for? What to pray for? Not short, not tall, not light, not dark. Just lo chacham velo tipesh. Lo chacham velo tipesh. Because there's a dark side to genius. There's another important aspect of Avraham Avinu, and it all is part of the same story. And more than that, we're going to see its significance. When Avraham Avinu is in the process, this week's every, he's in the process of praying for the people of Sodom. So first of all, why does he pray for the people of Sodom? You know why he prays for the people of Sodom? Because they're human beings. They have dignity and they have sanctity. And he hopes that maybe, if there are 10 tzaddikim, we'll be able to do something. He never gives up hope on men. Because he knows the greatness of men. He never gives up hope. In the middle of that prayer to God, you know what he says? V'anochi ofer v'ether. I am dust and ash. I'm nothing. And despite that, I want to pray before you. I want to beg you. Don't get angry with me. Is this just a form of, you know, it's going to sound good for the boys back home? When a form of you says, well, no, be off over Afer, and this is recorded in Torah, you can be absolutely certain that that's exactly how a form of you feels. Why does a form of you feel like that? Because he and all other human beings are all the same. All men are created equal. You understand what Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence by our fathers, you know, we live here. The only kind of genius who can be a source of blessing for the world is the one who's not conceited and not vain. Three or four of the wives of our great intellectuals said about them that their vanity and their conceit knew no end. They were convinced that they are God's gift to the world. They turned out to be God's curse to the world. Who else is the most humble man on the face of this earth?
Moshe
Rabbeinu. Onov mi od mi kol ha'adam. Onov mi od mi kol ha'adam. Asher al pnei ha'adam.
I'll just give you a few little insights over here into a few of our geniuses, as that Baron Schwarz Tadiagin. Schwarz Tadiagin, you have no idea. A large part of Rousseau's reputation rests on his theories about the upbringing of children. You remember who we're talking about now? Rousseau, the one who abandoned all five of his children at birth and never saw them and never cared about them. But in the theories of education. More education in the main is the underlying theme of his discourse and Reveal the Social Contract. It is curious that in real life, as opposed to writing, he took so little interest in children. Rousseau's warmest affection went to animals. Children he throws out into the street. Unbelievable. I've made so many. These were very sick people. Rousseau writes about the says the following.
Beyond the self-pity, he had a great deal of self-pity, lay an overpowering egoism, a feeling that he was quite unlike other men, both in his sufferings and his qualities. He wrote, "What could your miseries have in common with mine? My situation is unique, unheard of since the beginning of time. The person who can love me as I can love is still to be born." "No one ever had more talent for loving," he wrote. "I was born to be the best friend that ever existed." He ended up at the end of his life with not a single friend. He had... Shelley. We'll see what I'm going and I've gotten. Shelley was one of the great writers of all time. Shelley was astonishingly single-minded in the pursuit of his ideals, but ruthless and even brutal of disposing of anyone who got in his way. Like Rousseau, he loved humanity in general, but was often cruel to human beings in particular. He burned with a fierce love, but it was an abstract flame, and the poor mortals who came near it were often scorched. What a beautiful sentence.
Yeah.
He loves everybody, the whole world, and he destroys all of people. He put ideas before people, and his life is a testament to how heartless ideas can be. He was cruel, he was brutal. See, page 46. I mean, I can read the whole book for you, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. But it's a pattern. These are not unique and unusual. This is a pattern. Shelley, the man of truth and virtue, became a lifelong absconder and cheat. By the way, this is true of nearly every one of the intellectuals. He borrowed money everywhere and from all kinds of people, most of whom he never repaid. They were absolutely evil with regard to money. They would borrow, they would beg, they would get themselves invited to all sorts of people, though many of them were quite wealthy, and they never repaid. Ibsen, I'm always trying to figure out when I read it, who was the sickest of them all? There's no way. I'm beginning to think that maybe Uri Avneri may be the sickest of them all. Tolstoy in Russia was widely regarded as the world's greatest living writer and seer. And then they write that in his youth, he had not yet learned to despise his fellow human being and therefore lacked self-assurance. But he soon learned there was one aspect of Ibsen's vanity which verged on the ludicrous. Ibsen had a regard for medals. Medals, you know, medals. So any kind of organization that gave out medals, you know, send a Kellogg's box top, you know, 25 cents, and you get a medal. Or different organizations that gave the order of this or the order of that, he tried to get them. If they didn't want to give, he'd send letters, he'd get people to send letters, and they'd give him medals. And very often he would show up at lectures of his, you know, like a Russian field marshal. And people, he didn't realize that people were laughing at him. He looked like, and he was a Michigan until the end of his days. It was a Goyen Adir who could just have sat back and had a whole world approve of his genius. He was a genius. He's writing some of the greatest stuff that were. Yet this international celebrity, glittering with his trophies, gave an ultimate impression not so much of vanity, let alone of foolishness, but malevolent power and barely suppressed rage. Ibsen was quite proud to say, "Do you know that all my life I've turned my back on my parents, on my whole family?" When his father died in 1877, Ibsen had not been in touch with him for nearly 40 years. Is that Uri Ibsen? Uri Ibsen. The dark side. The frightening dark side.
Therefore, what really singles out Avraham are not the 70 years of great intellectual effort that finally bring him to an understanding and a knowledge of God, something that's going to shake the world of Avraham Hazeh. That's not where his greatness lies. And that's why the Torah didn't tell us that story. The Torah tells us his story that this extreme Gemilus Chesed, this is how he tempered his genius. This is what he wanted people to learn. The Gemara here says, and I mean, my own reading of it, but I think it's nice. The Gemara says, the fact that he leaves God, who was there in his presence, and he runs to bring these wayfarers and travelers, from this we learn, G'dola hachnosos orchim, greater is bringing the guest into your house, then Kabbalah's Pnei Hashchina, receiving the divine presence. I have no understanding of this. Kabbalah's Pnei Hashchina is what Avraham Avinu did in the first 70 years of his life. He finally came to see the divine presence. But you know what's greater than that first 70 years? The rest of his life. The rest of his life, which is devoted to Achnasa Sarkim, his humility, his understanding of the honor and the dignity of man and the sanctity of human beings. And therefore, once he understands that, he realizes that his great task is not going to be Torah. Yaakov will take care of Torah. Hachmas HaZarachim is going to be his. Because otherwise, genius, unchecked by Torah, becomes cruel, brutal, destructive, in a relentless way, ruthless. And it's the story throughout history. It's all true throughout all of history. They're in life. Yes, the greatness of Avraham is this old, sick man running out into that cruel, hot day in order to bring the Zarchim. Now we understand why he prays. Now we understand why it's important for the house of Avraham that a shidduch for Yitzhak, is going to have to be a chip off the old block. It's going to have to be somebody who is irrational in Achas Zarchim. We understand why he's going to gamble with his whole life in order to save love. And by the way, the great lover of mankind, and this is important, when he knows that you have to fight, you fight. And if he knows that you have to kill, you kill. He's not a blind machnis aura. Here are people who've waged war and brought destruction on the world for 26 years, and now they've taken my nephew. I'm going to go out if I have to destroy him. It will hurt him afterwards, but he knows what he has to do. He's not blind to the fact that there is great cruelty out there in that world. He's not blind to what Sodom is. He knows exactly what Sodom is. Can you now imagine what an awesome and frightening test the Akedah was? A man who has made of himself complete chesed has to take his one and only child and bring him as a sacrifice. Is there anything that goes more against everything that is the personality of Avraham? Unbelievable. But he still knows there's one being higher than him, and that's the Rabbeinu Shem. And ultimately, of course, the Rabbeinu Shem wanted to let him know that this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. But man, the great genius, has to bow before Rabbeinu Shlomo, the authority of a God, whether I understand or I don't understand. That's the basis of what Avraham teaches for all generations to come.